It will now be my privilege to introduce Elder Echohawk to you. Elder Larry Echohawk currently serves as a member of the First Quorum of the 70. Most recently, he served, I think, 3 years, Larry?
3 years
as Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in the U.S. Department of the Interior. In this position, he oversaw 566 tribal nations. Elder Echohawk received a bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University and a Juris Doctorate degree from the University of Utah. He served as the first American Indian in U.S. history to be elected as a state attorney general in Idaho. He's also worked as a prosecuting attorney, served two consecutive terms in the Idaho House of Representatives, and later worked as a law professor at BYU. Elder Echohawk has served the church in many capacities, including as a bishop, high priest group instructor, and as stake president. He and his wife, Terry, have 6 children, and we're grateful to have them here with us today. Elder Echohawk, we're thankful that you're here and look forward to your message.
Thank you, President Clark, and assume we have faculty members today, or maybe your non-traditional students I see out there look a little older than the rest, but it's good to see so many students. It feels good to be back on a university campus. For the last 3 years, I've been in Washington, D.C., working for the federal government, and before that, I was 14 years as a law professor at BYU, so I like the atmosphere of a university. It's an honor for me to have been invited to be the forum speaker today, and I've decided to say a few words about my journey in life, but my message is really about the power of a university education and the opportunity that education gives us to serve others and to try to make this world a better place. I also want to say something about American Indians, about the goodness of this great nation, but also about its challenges. And since I'm a lawyer, I should start with a disclaimer. And that is that I speak today in this forum setting as the former Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. And thus, you will hear me commenting from a Native American perspective. And I hope that my message today fits the purpose of the forum, which I think it does, because in the letter that was sent to me, it reads, "The forum program is designed to stretch the intellect of students, to introduce them to new ideas and make them aware of current events and important social issues, and to give them an opportunity to meet with business, civic, and academic leaders." So, my disclaimer is that I'm not here as a general authority of the church, you know, delivering this message. At least in the main body of my comments. As I finish up today, I'll probably sound like a general authority. But when I was invited to present this forum presentation, it was back in September when I was serving as the Assistant Secretary and I was asked to come and speak about Indian affairs. To set the stage for my comments, I want to begin with 2 quotes. They come from D.H. Lawrence, who was a scholar, a writer, a philosopher back in the 1800s. And he traveled the American continent, lived in the United States for a while, and he said, "If you are an American, you are part Indian in your roots." Of course, because at one time, what now is the United States of America was Indian country. And the second quote is that the American Indian, he said, will never again control this continent, but he will forever haunt it. Now, what does that mean to you? To me, when I hear that, that he will forever haunt it, it speaks to what the past history of the United States has been in its relations to the first Americans, meaning the American Indians. So I want to begin with my name, Echo Hawk. That is the name that was given to my great-grandfather, a Pawnee Indian who did not speak English, born in the mid-1800s in what we now call Nebraska. At that time, Pawnee Indians did not have first and last names like we have today. Rather, they earned a name. The elders of the tribe would watch a young man and observe something about him, and then he would get a name from those elders. And the oral story that's been passed down from generation to generation is that these elders recognized that my great-grandfather was a brave young man. And among the Pawnee, the hawk is a symbol of a warrior. So he was known for his bravery, but he was also observed to be a quiet person who did not speak of his own deeds. But other members of his tribe did, and it was like an echo from one side of the village to the other as they spoke of his deeds. And thus he was named Echo Hawk. In other words, the hawk whose deeds are echoed. Of course, that's the English translation. And that later became the surname in our family. So if you ever met someone with the name Echo Hawk, I can guarantee it's a close relative. The Pawnee people, according to the estimates of the first white men that came in contact with them, they didn't do a formal census, obviously, but they estimated that they numbered about 20,000 living on the Great Plains of what is now Nebraska, especially along the riverways in that territory. And under the laws of the United States that were developing at that time, Native Americans, Indian tribes, were recognized to have property rights in the areas that they occupied and had occupied for generations. Under the laws of the United States, this was called a right of occupancy. And later, the United States Supreme Court would say that right of occupancy is as sacred as fee simple absolute. So unless you've gone to law school, maybe you don't know what fee simple absolute stands for, but it means you own that land and you are the sole owner. Well, they had this property right to 23 million acres of land, but in 1874, the Pawnee people were expelled from their homeland by the United States government to make way for settlement. My great-grandfather, Echo Hawk, was 19 years old at that time when the military escorted the Pawnee people southward into what was known as the Oklahoma Indian Territory. And there they were placed on a small reservation in north-central Oklahoma along the Cimarron River. I can't imagine how painful that must have been for my great-grandfather, that 19-year-old, to be driven from his home, no longer able to go back to his ancestral burial sites or to return to the sacred areas that were important to the spirituality of their people, no longer able to pursue the great buffalo herds that had sustained them in their way of life, because they were confined to a small reservation where they were forced to subsist on handouts from the government, rations. One of the most free and independent and self-sustaining of all people on the face of the earth, almost overnight, because of the policies of the United States of America, became one of the most dependent people on the face of the earth. That is a painful history, but it is a history that was shared by numerous tribes spread across the United States. But out of that pain was born promise. In my generation, of the 6 children that were born to my parents, all 6 of us went to college. 3 of us became lawyers, the first generation to graduate from a university. We received the best that this country has to offer, the full promise of America. Perhaps the greatest realization of that promise for me came in 1990 here in the state of Idaho. That's when I made the decision to run for a statewide political office. I had been serving as the attorney for Idaho's largest Indian tribe, the Shoshone and Bannock tribes located on the Fort Hall Indian Reservation, not very far from here, located essentially between Blackfoot and Pocatello and American Falls. And I knew that that would be a difficult endeavor to run for that office and to prevail in the election, because in my political party, there hadn't been any person elected to that office in 20 years. I was running for the office of Attorney General in the state. There hadn't been anyone from Bannock County elected to any statewide office in 38 years. I did not know this, but it was soon reported in the news that in all the history of the United States of America, there had never been an American Indian elected to any statewide state constitutional office, like a governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, or attorney general. And I remember when I found that out, you know, it energized me to work harder in that campaign. But it wasn't long after I filed that petition for candidacy where I got deflated. And it seems like I had to take a step backward, because the largest newspaper in Idaho, the Idaho Statesman, had a political writer that wrote an article. And he said, "Larry Echohawk has no chance to win election as Attorney General." In the article said, he said, "Because he has 3 strikes against him at the very beginning. He's a Mormon, Indian, Democrat." And if you know Idaho, you'd say you're out. But I had a strategy, and that is to go out and convince the people of Idaho that Echohawk is an Irish name. See, it's Echohawk. Just kidding. I didn't do that because I'm very proud of that name, proud of my Pawnee Indian heritage. And I wanted the people of Idaho to know and to actually see something different. And I worked very hard in that campaign. And I remember I just told myself, I'm going to hold on to the values that I was raised with. And as I went through that campaign toward the end, I didn't have a lot of campaign funds, so I couldn't afford the polling that is very critical to a campaign But toward the end, the news media will help you out there, because the televisions, the newspapers, they do their own polling. And when I started to see those poll numbers come back from the news media, I knew that I had a chance, that it was very close. And so, you know, we finished out that campaign, and I was at a hotel in Pocatello on the night of the election, a hotel, because that's where they were tallying the votes statewide. So we were there to learn what would happen in that election. I was there with my family, and at this particular moment that I want to describe, I was in a room at that hotel with my four-year-old son, just the two of us. And he had tried to stay up late, but it was so late because it was a close race that he had fallen asleep. He was on the bed when the telephone rang, and it was my opponent, a very good opponent. And in a very dignified voice, he said, "Congratulations." I would have the opportunity to serve as Idaho's 36th Attorney General. I remember sitting in that hotel room, knowing that in a few moments I would walk out and face a group of news reporters. And it was a little larger group than normal, because this was an opportunity for American history, and that had attracted some attention. As I collected my thoughts, I walked out without any written speech, stood before the reporters, and repeated some words that I had heard when I was 15 years old. I actually saw it on a black and white television set, spoken by a black civil rights leader standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. I get a little emotional even thinking about that, because for the past 3 years, in my service in Washington, D.C., I've lived in Arlington, Virginia. And every day that I would drive into the office at the Department of Interior, I would cross the memorial. The Memorial Bridge, and drive right past the Lincoln Memorial to the Department of Interior, located on Constitution Avenue, a block and a half from the White House. But that night, I remembered those words that I had heard at age 15, and I repeated them from memory. I have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream, that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of that creed. I have a dream that one day my children will be raised in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. That evening, I felt the power of those words and the realization of that dream and the promise of America. I could not have achieved that moment in history had I not had that opportunity to obtain a university education and a vision of what a person can do with that education. I have been blessed in life to have many mentors, people that have influenced me for good. I want to take just a moment and describe one of them. It's my older brother. He's the person I call the famous Echo Hawk. I say that because a few years ago, I opened a National Geographic magazine, and they had a really nice several-page article about Native Americans. And they had a real nice map that showed all of the Indian tribes of the United States. And then along the borders of the map were the famous Indian, like Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Geronimo, and John Echo Hawk, my older brother. That's a good role model. He was one of the first American Indians to obtain a law degree. He was the first graduate of a program called the Special Scholarship Program in Law for American Indians, designed to recruit American Indians that are so heavily impacted by law and to send them to school, instill with them a motivation to return to their communities to help lift their people, to help change the laws, to protect their rights. And so John Echo Hawk, when he was in law school about ready to graduate, he pulled his little brother aside one day, and to me he said, "Larry, I think you should go to law school." That was a pretty wild thought, because I was a BYU football player. What do you think my head had been? I was lined up to graduate and to become a football coach in Blanding, Utah, which I think would have been a good life. That's a worthy profession. But he said you should go to law school. And I remember I asked him, I said, "Why should I go to law school?" And here's the answer that he gave me. He said, "Because it will give you the power to change." And I'm embarrassed to say that when he told me that, I thought he was talking about me. I could already see a nicer home with a new car in the driveway. Because lawyers, they usually make more money than high school football coaches, right? And that's what I was thinking. I got this education for me. And if I get a law school education, that's going to be for me. His message is, you have the power to change, which he then described, the lives of other people, to use your education to serve others, to bless their lives. I was a little embarrassed, but I was listening. I watched him. He graduated. He took the lowest paying job in the legal profession. It's called legal services. Born out of the civil rights era of the 1960s, designed to give poor people, lawyers, legal representation that they had not been able to have. His first job was with the California Indian Legal Services, working for impoverished Native people in the state of California. And he was a good example. So I went to law school, and his credo became my credo, to return something for what you've received, to use your education to bless the lives of other people. And I have been blessed to be able to use my education to help lift others. You know what my first job was? California Indian Legal Services. In the footsteps of my older brother. To me, it was like a two-year mission to go and work for poor people who didn't have lawyers. From there, I had a string of about 22 years of giving public service. As a tribal attorney at Fort Hall, as a state legislator in the House of Representatives, as a prosecuting attorney, elected prosecutor of Bannock County, Idaho, and then, of course, as Attorney General for the state of Idaho. And it was a wonderful experience. My wife actually teases me. She says, "Larry, you can't hold a stable job." But I've been blessed to be able to do these different things with my education. And the capstone, I thought, was when I was asked to serve on the faculty at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University to teach criminal law to first-year students, evidence, criminal procedure, criminal trial practice, and every once in a while, just to keep me happy, federal Indian law. I loved it. I say the perfect life. And if that wasn't good enough, President Samuelson at the university a few years ago called me into his office and said, "I have another assignment. You still have to do your law school duties, but every university under the umbrella of the NCAA has to designate one faculty member to oversee all men and women's athletics." And he said, "Professor Echohawk, that's your new assignment." And I sat there trying to be as dignified as I could. "Yes, sir." Inside, I said, "Yes." You know what that means? I had to travel with the football team to the Las Vegas Bowl, to the Rose Bowl, you know, the Mountain West basketball tournament in Las Vegas for a whole week. You know, you've got to see the coaches and the student athletes at work, sideline passes at the football game, like University of Utah, BYU. Is that a good life? Teaching law school and doing that? Well, it started to change on January 13th of 2009. I was sitting in my law school office when the telephone rang, and the person on the line said, "We have an airline ticket for you. The presidential transition team would like to talk to you in Washington, D.C." I had not worked on the Obama campaign. I had not been a donor. I was just a humble law professor, enjoying a good life. But when the presidential transition team calls like that, what are you supposed to say? So I said, "Okay." And I got on the airliner, and I flew back to Washington, D.C., and I had an address that was given to me, and I went to the office building and walked inside and was peppered with questions for about an hour. No jobs mentioned. So it was late at night, and when I finished up the interview, they had a hotel room for me in Washington. I went there, getting ready for bed, the telephone rang. The voice on the line said some very powerful words. "Your country is calling you into service." And I was offered the nomination of the President of the United States to serve as the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. You probably don't know what an Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs does. Here's the civics lesson. The Assistant Secretary is an officer of the United States of America. That's the language in the Constitution of the United States. It requires not only a nomination from the president, but a confirmation by the United States Senate. That means the Senate has to vote you in after the president nominates you. The assistant secretary oversees Indian affairs and executes the trust responsibility of the United States of America in its relations to 566 tribes, tribal nations. The Assistant Secretary oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Bureau of Indian Education. That means responsibility over 55 million acres of land, overseeing 183 schools, K through 12, 27 tribal colleges, 2 tribal universities, and 2 technical colleges. I went from overseeing 1 teaching assistant to having responsibility to supervise 10,000 employees and administering a budget of $2.5 billion. I just have to take a breath after that one. So what did I say? Your country is calling you into service. You know what I said? I have to think about that. Why would I say that? Because I knew that if I said yes, I received the confirmation of the United States Senate, I would become the face of the federal government in Indian country. And there have been some very dark and haunting chapters in American history when it comes to Indian affairs. I got on the airplane and I flew back to Utah. Arrived home, went immediately into my study to the bookcase. I took a book off the shelf that I read when I was a graduating law student at the University of Utah. It was a national bestseller written by Dee Brown. The title of the book was Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. You ought to read it. It takes a period of 1860 to 1890, 30 years. Each chapter is devoted to just one tribe and what the United States did, mainly through the military, to dispossess those native peoples of their homelands. Why did I do that? I wanted to be reminded about those dark and haunting chapters before I said yes. I didn't have to be reminded about what I call legal subjugation of those Indian tribes under the law of the United States, because that's what I taught 23 times. I knew all the cases, all the statutes, all of the broken treaties. I hesitated, but I could not say no. It was an opportunity to serve, to try to make a difference, and to bring about change, positive change. And so I said yes, and that's when the vetting started. Vetting, where the FBI goes into every community you've ever lived to see if you're worthy to serve in the federal government. I have to say that there was just one moment in that vetting process where the FBI senior agent came to my home in Orem, Utah. She was wrapping up the investigation. She came in and said, "We're going to recommend you to the White House, you know, to follow through with the confirmation process. You passed," in other words. She got up and started heading toward the door, and she turned around. She said, "I probably shouldn't say this, but you are the most boring person I've ever investigated." In the last part of her investigation, she had gone in the neighborhood, door to door, asking people what they thought about Larry Echohawk. I was the bishop in that ward. So I was granted a leave of absence from my teaching at the law school at BYU, and on June 1st of 2009, I walked down the hallway in the Department of Interior. It's got a sign above the door leading into the hallway, and that sign says, "The Hall of Tribal Nations," And along that long hallway are lined the flags of the tribal nations of the United States. In the very back is the office of the Assistant Secretary. You know how I felt that day? I felt like an endangered species. You know why I say that? Because in the prior 8 years, 6 people had held that job. It's what I call difficult job. But I walked down that hallway wanting to only do what is right and just, not only for the first Americans, but for America to do it right, to execute the trust responsibility of the United States, the solemn promises that were made in treaties endorsed by the President and the United States of America should be upheld. I believe in America. I believe in the spirit of America that says no matter who you are, whatever your race, your religion, your ethnic heritage, or your economic station in life, this must be a land of opportunity for all people. All people deserve the protection of the law. Native Americans were scattered, smitten, and nearly destroyed. I hope those words that I just spoke sounded familiar. Words from the Book of Mormon. Most of our lands were taken, but solemn promises were given in return. Most of those promises were not kept. Neglect in keeping those promises led to suffering, generation after generation. Today, our needs remain great. We are the most impoverished ethnic minority in the United States. But we are now writing new chapters of American history that are more promising and not dark and haunting. As Assistant Secretary, I faithfully executed the trust responsibility of the United States of America because I believed that great nations like great men should keep their promises. I did all I could to see that our nation kept its word. It was the most difficult thing that I have done in my life. But we did accomplish much that made and is making the difference in the lives of people. Now, in conclusion, I'm taking off that hat as the former Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs for the United States of America. And now I may sound like a general authority. I intended to finish my term of service in the Obama administration. I had applied for an extension of my leave of absence to be able to do so. The law school dean was in 100% support. That is very unusual for a university to grant nearly 4 years of leave to a faculty member. I was virtually certain it would be approved. But in late January, I received another phone call. It was from the Office of the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they said, we need to set up an interview with you and your wife, with a member of the presidency. And on February 3rd, that led to a call to serve. This time, there was no hesitation whatsoever. I knew before I ever sat down for that interview that no matter what was asked, the answer would be emphatic yes. And a call was extended to serve in the first quorum of the 70. My thoughts go back to two missionaries. Boyd Kamphuisen, Lee Pearson. Those are the names of the missionaries that came into my home and introduced us to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Before that, I think I had been in a church. I was a teenager at that time. I think I had been in a church two times, not the LDS church. It was like a Christmas program, or maybe Easter Sunday. I didn't know anything about Christian religion when those missionaries came to see us. A priest quorum advisor by the name of Richard Boren, who challenged me as a 17-year-old to read the Book of Mormon. And a prophet of God that gave me a vision of what I should be doing. That prophet of God was Spencer W. Kimball. In the Book of Mormon, in the very first page, when I was 17 years old, and I made a commitment to read 10 pages a night until I finished this book. It would be the largest book I'd ever read at that point. I was not a good student. It says on the title page that the Book of Mormon is written to the Lamanites, who are a remnant of the house of Israel, and also to the Jew and Gentile. You turn to the next page in the introduction, and Lamanites, that was a new term. I didn't know what that was. But you read there that the Lamanites are the principal ancestors of the American Indians. You think that got my attention as a young Indian boy growing up? As I read the Book of Mormon, I learned a lot. And as I knelt down after reading that book, I had a very powerful spiritual experience where I knew it was true. That has sustained me for years. That prophet of the Lord, Spencer W. Kimball, had a special love for American Indians. I heard him speak when he talked about a dream that he had. And he said, maybe it was a vision. Maybe the Lord was showing me to me what great things this people, referring to the Lamanites, would accomplish. He said, I had a dream of your progress and development. I saw the people of Lehi as engineers and builders. I saw you in great political positions and functioning as administrators of the land. I saw many of you as heads of governments and of counties, states, and cities. I saw you in legislative positions where you, as good legislators and good Latter-day Saints, were able to make the best laws to help your brothers and sisters. I saw you becoming attorneys. I took those words and they went in my Book of Mormon. I read them over and over. It became the blueprint for life. The power of a university education connected up with a vision of what you can do with that education and realizing that you do have the power to change. That applies to all of us. I bear testimony that the gospel of Jesus Christ has been restored through the prophet Joseph Smith, that he was the instrument in the hands of the Lord in bringing forth the Book of Mormon, that the power of the priesthood has been restored to these latter days. What a blessing it is for us to now be a part of that as this great work rolls forth across the nations of the world. If we work as if everything depended upon us, and we pray as if everything depended upon the Lord, and we maintain our personal worthiness to be receptive to the influence of the Holy Ghost, we can become the hands of the Lord in carrying forth his work, this marvelous work and wonder. And I bear that testimony in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.